This is Dr. Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2015 podcast series. Today we are speaking with Dr. Frank Burnett about his book, Career Errors, Straight Talk About the Steps and Missteps of Career Development. Dr. Frank Burnett has been involved in education, counseling, and human resource development his entire career. Most recently, he served as president of Education Now, a private consulting, training, and program development firm with offices in Springfield, Virginia, and Rockport, Maine. From 1987 to 1994, he served as the executive director of the National Association for College Admission Counseling, an education organization representing counselors, admission officers, and related educators working in the nation's schools and colleges. Before joining NACAC, he held a variety of administrative positions, including associate executive director during his 16-year tenure at the American Counseling Association, and state supervisor of counseling with the Pennsylvania Department of Education. Frank is the author of numerous publications, including Bound for College Guidebook, Bound for Career Guidebook, and Career Errors, Straight Talk About the Steps and Missteps of Career Development. All are available from the Rowan and Littlefield Publishing Group. Welcome, Frank.
Great to be with you, Rebecca. I'm looking forward to being a part of the 2015 ACA podcast series.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, we're going to dive right into the questions. Your book, Career Errors, is built on the premise that we all pass through a series of career development stages, and too few of us understand or implement those stages properly. Can you please tell us more about the stages?
Yes, Rebecca. As we know as counselors, there are a variety of life stages in the human growth and development process.
Yes.
Each of those life stages can convert to some aspect or some connection to the career development process. And what happens in each of these stages is unique and very, very different for every individual. That's what makes them a challenging part of what the counselor has to deal with. I have identified, and I don't think it's too far off of counseling, career counseling theory, I have identified eight stages: awareness, exploration, goal setting, decision making, something I call knowledge and skill acquisition and competency attainment, orientation, entry and adjustment, growth, mobility, and maintenance, and then a thing I call winding down, adjustment, and exit. Now, that pretty much takes you from being about a 3-year-old to being about a 103-year-old.
Yeah.
Counselors working in schools and colleges are definitely going to be exposed to clients dealing with the early stages. Counselors in community agencies and organizations are going to find a strong likelihood that they're going to interface with people across the lifespan and experience probably any or one or more of those eight stages. Then there's going to be the counselor who's going to find his or her way to a mental health counselor or a private practitioner, or maybe even someone working in a firm or business related employee assistance program. These people are going to have a different take on how career affects where they're in counseling. The person who's unemployed or chronically unemployed may also have mental health issues. Mm-hmm. The counselor with who is differently able is going to have to overcome that different ability in order to progress successfully through the career development process. So counselors at every level, counselors in every setting need to know more about the career development process. Now, I called my book Career Errors for a very, very simple reason. I wanted people to look at it from, and my readers are both counselors and consumers or in this case, clients of counselors. I wanted my readers to understand that there is, first of all, a process. The first error in my book is that we don't teach people the career development process. They go through it, but they don't know they're going through it.
Mm-hmm.
They experience all these stages, but they don't know why they're unique or why they're happening. Now, the final thing I want to say about this process called career development is that too many people think of it in a linear or ladder kind of context. It is linear and ladder-like to a degree, but it's also recycling of these various stages. Some people are going to go around and around and around before they get to where they really want to be in the career development process. Now, the reason I talk about recycling in the book is that because we're changing as people.
Mm-hmm.
The person that I am or you are today is different than the person we were yesterday or 20 years ago. The person we'll be tomorrow may not be even recognizable to us. So we have to be constantly placing our pulse on where people are in this thing, which I call the career development process.
And, you know, Frank, when I was a brand new counselor many years ago, I thought that I wouldn't be dealing with that much career stuff. I thought I was a mental health counselor, and the career counselors would be dealing with career stuff. And I found out when my clients taught me, which I always say my clients taught me everything, that many times career issues were all wound around other issues that were causing depression and anxiety. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I agree totally. And that's why I think that any counselor dealing with any life stage, dealing with any age group, working in any counseling setting is going to find that they're going to rub up against career development concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll use a term later that I call, it's an interesting thing and it's come up. And it's not in my book, interestingly. Someone came up with it in discussing this with me on a radio interview. And this interview person said to me, "Sounds like some people have chronic career disorder." And I thought of all the disorders in life, and maybe they do. People who don't get this right are going to find it to be either a deterrent to life satisfaction, or it's going to be an anchor that keeps them from achieving what they want to achieve.
Mm-hmm. You also place a great deal of emphasis on achieving life-work balance. Sometimes counselors are the worst at that. But anyway, just what is it, life-work balance, and how will a person know when she or he has found it?
Well, right off the bat, I have to say, I use the term life-work balance when most people use a term work-life balance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably the term most familiar to your podcast participants.
Mm-hmm.
I reverse the terms deliberately to insert career and work within the totality of our lives, not the other. I think that we should be seeking life-work balance. Even when we're not at work, some people think they're working, and it certainly has an impact. But even when we're working, our lives should be paramount. We should be thinking about the things that are going on in our individual lives, in our family lives, in our friendships and social lives. Early in our careers, we develop a sense of interests and values and life preferences. We all do. Some people like photography. Some people like sports. Some people like to read. Some people want to go to church, and some people are or synagogue, and some people want to go to a baseball game. We're all different in the interests and the values and the life preferences that we develop. Once those interests, values, and preferences mature and become fixed in our psyche, we want to make as many of these connections as we can throughout our life and our work. Now, we didn't always do it this way. And the baby boomers were much more tied to their work and much more tied to their occupations and careers than the young people of today. The Gen Xers, the Gen Yers, and the millennials are making it clear that they want either a work-life balance or a life-work balance that allows them to enjoy both. Mm-hmm. Part of choosing the first job, part of choosing a later job, or even accepting a promotion, may be determined by the degree to which that next step in the workplace is going to balance life and afford one the opportunity to enjoy the experiences and see that their interests and their values and their preferences come to play.
I love that, life-work balance. I think I'm going to start saying that. Okay, early in your book, you suggest that the worst question you should ever ask a young person is, what do you want to be when you grow up, which is something we all ask young people. Why is that a bad question?
Well, I call it the 10 most dangerous words in the career counseling process. I move at it from this direction. The U.S. Department of Labor lists several hundred occupations in the Occupational Outlook Handbook.
Mm-hmm.
These are the most popular and the most populated occupations, that the ones that most Americans work at. There was a time that when the now defunct Dictionary of Occupational Titles, again a U.S. Department of Labor publication, actually listed thousands of occupations, not hundred, that are performed in the American work enterprise. Asking anyone, especially a 7 or an 8 or maybe even a 12 or 13-year-old, what they want to be when they grow up, is to ask them to identify a single occupation and dismiss or discount so many hundreds of others. I'm into asking, and I think that's akin to putting blinders on people when we should probably be opening their horizons. When we do it with the young, I think they tend to think of things narrowly, and then the options then for them are restricted. Throughout life, however, I think that we tend to limit options and choices when we should be opening options and choices. In my book, I address the need to help our clients view the world of work as a lattice, not a ladder. And in a lattice concept of career movement, you move right and left as much as you move up in the ladder concept. So some people, I always use the example of the executive chef. The executive chef was probably a baker at one point. The executive chef was probably a salad maker at one point. They were probably a sous chef at one point. They did all of these things horizontally, and that prepared them both mentally and occupationally to move up the ladder and become the executive chef. So I don't like the expression, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I certainly don't like it when we ask it of people and then ask them to stop thinking about other choices.
The book goes into considerable detail about our inability to make good career or job decisions. Exactly what are most people doing wrong, and how can counselors help?
Well, interestingly, I found after I'd finished the book that almost every chapter went back to something dealing with decision-making.
Mm.
Whether you choose the right training program or the right college or the right graduate school, or whether once I'm working, I do the right thing with continuing education to advance my skills. Whether I choose the right job, whether I choose the promotion when it's before me. And then at the very end of our life stages, do I retire at the right time? Do I exit the workforce at the right time? Every one of those interfaces, every one of those intersections puts us into a place where we have to make a decision, or maybe multiple decisions. So I think the role of the counselor, and I always remember one of my favorite people in American history, Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin once wrote that if you're going to make good decisions, you have to know what the decision-making process is all about. And this is where he said, if you don't know what you don't know, you're going to really be the world's worst decision-maker. Franklin and others have advanced the idea that decision-making has several aspects to it, the first of which is you have to know that there's a decision to be made.
Mm-hmm.
This happens to kids in the school all the time. I remember as a personal anecdote, I was in Spanish class one day as a 10th grader, and I don't remember how I got there. Well, I didn't either fill out the forms right, or somebody made a decision for me. Now, fortunately, I was able to change it to something I wanted to change to study. But see, that's a clear example that if you don't take control of the decision-making process and you don't know there's a decision right before you, someone else could very likely make it for you. Now, once you know what that decision is, and maybe it's a fork in the road and you either follow road A or road B, or maybe it's a really tough decision where you have four or five or six decision options. But once you know that you have a decision, you have to flush out the range of options. What is it? I'm going to take A, I'm going to take B, I'm going to go north, I'm going to go south. Once this is known, then you prioritize those options. What's good about this one? What's bad about this one? You know, it's that old thing we learned many, many years ago in personal management. Put a line down down the center of a piece of paper, and what are the pluses on one side? What are the negatives and the minuses on the other side? That's the prioritizing of options. Then you have to decide. Well, the biggest enemy of deciding is procrastinating. Some people don't want to do it.
Yeah.
Some people want someone to. And don't think that someone's not going to lay this problem on a counselor. Tell me what to do.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I don't know what to do. Help. And that can be the worst mistake a counselor makes because if the client isn't invested in the decision, he or she doesn't have to make it work as if they made the decision themselves. The final part of the process is, and this is where the counselor can come to play again, it's certainly a place where we can help support the client, we can help facilitate the decision they make, and as they evaluate it, they may have to admit to something very, very, very negative. God, I made a mistake. Oh, I made a mistake. I need to get out of this. And then that may be a time when some serious counseling may come to play. The counselor is a significant player in all of these aspects of the decision-making process. In short, I guess counselors help clients with the process, and then they provide support for their clients once she or he has made a decision. If clients don't make, and I'm going to put the word own in quotes, if they don't own their decision, they are likely not to make a full investment in making them work.
And isn't it true, interestingly enough, that some people will make a decision, like a young lady I know who made a decision to go to law school. She decided as she was graduating that she didn't want to be a lawyer. But what she became was a legal journalist and ended up doing combining two things that she loved. She loved journalism in her undergraduate, and she loved law, but she didn't want to be an attorney in a classic sense. So sometimes it's not even a mistake in the end. Is that correct?
Well, you know, and you hit on one of the really interesting hot buttons that I talk about in the book, is that people sometimes, and this goes back to the information they possess, they sometimes look at things too narrowly. Your friend was looking at writing and law, and in the eyes of some people, that's two different and separate things. Mm-hmm. She brought them together and made it very, very, very important. The thing I think is important is for people to understand how to broaden a perspective. The other thing that I think people do wrong is that they tie themselves to something after they make a decision and they don't reverse it. They don't go back.
Yes.
If you have, you know, the average person in this country is going to spend 25 to 30 to 40 years of their life working. That's a long time. You know, that's a long time for a judge to sentence somebody to prison.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long time for you to sentence yourself to a job or an occupation.
In one chapter, you talked about the inability to find good information upon which to make these decisions and our failure to use it properly once we do. Can you be more specific, especially regarding the role which counselors can play at this stage of career development?
I once was the supervisor of counseling in a middle school in Northern Virginia, and I knew one of my counselors was doing some interesting work with 11 and 12-year-olds in career exploration. My counselor ended a group session one day, and she looked around, and the kids were all gone, and the students were all gone, and she had this panicked look on her face, and I saw her head off to the... We had within the school library a little thing called the Career Resource Center. So I followed her down with interest, and I looked over her shoulder, and I said, "Gail, what are you doing in such a hurry?" And she says, "Well, this young boy in the session we just had said he wanted to be a forester. Well, I don't have a clue what foresters do. When he comes back next week, I told him to look here and look here. But when he comes back next week, I want to know as much about forestry as he does." Well, I looked at Gail and I said, "Gail, that you did the right thing in telling him where to go to look. You can't be expected to know everything there is to know. I have in my book about 20 characteristics and describe 20 characteristics of every job. If you multiply 20 characteristics times 500 occupations, that's an information explosion. And plus the fact that these jobs are changing all the time. Yeah. There was a time when there was a dearth of information. We mm-hmm. didn't have enough, and most of it was only available in a print format. Boy, has that changed with the information and technology revolution. You can look. I worry today that the information explosion is going to bewilder people, and I also worry that the internet and some of the places where good career information has been placed, they're just not keeping it up to date. Yeah. I once told somebody that the worst thing you can have in a piece of career information is a number.
Mm-hmm.
And the greatest example of that is college tuition. Look at how much college cost has changed in the last decade.
Yeah.
There's one other thing that comes into this whole picture at this point, and that's social media.
Mm-hmm.
Social media has evolved as an incredible information tool, not only for people to look for information, but for others to see information about them.
Mm-hmm.
Job seekers today are using LinkedIn, they're using Facebook, they're using other sites to look, especially, you know, once they've decided what they want to do and they've studied and they're now looking for a job.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a reverse to that. The employers are looking at them via
yes.
Facebook
yes.
and LinkedIn and all those kinds of things. And there's one recent study by the Society for Human Resource Development that 9 in 10 HR officers have used social media to fill positions.
Yes.
Now, counselors don't have to be fountains of specific information,
mm-hmm.
but it helps if they can direct the uninformed to quality resources. And then when that young boy came back
mm-hmm.
the next week, she didn't have to know it if he knew it. All she had to do was say, "What did you find out? How does that relate to what your interests and aptitudes and abilities are?"
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to be the information. We have to know where it is and help our clients evaluate it and then infuse it into their decision-making.
You mentioned a young boy, and you mentioned a little bit ago about college tuition. And I was thinking, you know, another thing counselors deal with, and this is, I guess, secondary to some of these career things, is that the parents come in for counseling.
Oh,
the
yeah.
parents are very nervous about what their child's going to be. They see it as some kind of reflection of their worth. And then there's a second thing, and that is that that parents are coming in and saying, "My kid's in so much debt. I'm so worried about that, with college is costing so much money." So what do you think? Do you think the parents are often a part of the anxiety and worry?
Well, certainly with adolescents and young adults, parents are going to, a lot of people say they're looking forward to the empty nest, but they want to make sure that the empty nest doesn't get returned to. parents are incredibly important to the process, but they have to understand that It's not their role as parents to make life impacting decisions for their children. I don't care if that child is 5 years old or that child is 15 or 25.
Mm-hmm.
If that, going back to what I said earlier about decision making, if the individual doesn't own the decision, he or she will not make the investment in it to make sure that it happens. Now, there's one other thing about information, and you hit one of the important issues here. There are some things that affect and restrict people today. One of those is money.
Yeah.
The cost of college, the whole concern that we have now over a lending society that's going to be burdened by debt. But there are other influences that are not fair. Women have traditionally not seen themselves in some roles, and that's incredibly important.
Mm-hmm.
Girls and women have to understand that there isn't a position in this country, a work position, a political position, a university position, that they should not aspire to. The same for racial and ethnic minorities.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't bring balance and fairness and diversity of consideration to the whole information process, then we failed. I want to see more role models.
Yeah.
I want to see the male kindergarten teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see the African American banker. I want to see the woman who is doing something that men have only ever traditionally done. I turned on a television recently and I saw a woman officiating a men's football game. What a great role model she is to other young women who maybe said, I can't be a referee. That's a man's occupation. So there are a lot of things, a lot of concerns about information that I think counselors can, if they can't break the total knowledge,
mm-hmm.
maybe parents have been so influential that they have, I often say, the parent's job is to guide, not to steer.
Mm.
If you look up the word guide and steer in the dictionary,
mm-hmm.
they mean the same, but they don't mean the same.
Mm.
I can guide you without steering you.
Yeah.
If I'm steering you, it's like in the old days when we had driver education cars that had dual controls.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a dual control situation. At some point in time, young adults, children, adolescents, young adults, and in some cases later in life, people have to take the wheel and steer themselves, or they're just not going to get to where they want to be.
Absolutely, and I like I like what you said about women and about roles. I was in a hospital recently, and at this hospital, the nurses came in at every shift and introduced themselves to you. I'm going to be your nurse tonight. And once a young gentleman came in who looked like a weightlifter, and he said, I'm going to be your nurse tonight. And I, even though I've been a counselor for 30 years, I had to stop and think, wow, okay, that is not what I expected. I didn't expect a young male weightlifter looking person to come in and say, I'm going to be your nurse tonight. Okay, back to the book. You have a chapter in your book in which you profile about 20 career clusters and identify a large number of new and emerging occupations. How is the workplace changing, and what must a counselor do or know to stay on top of that change?
Well, this is a chapter in the book in which I really emphasize again the taking off of blinders.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that the person who combined law and writing.
Yes.
They are different clusters. I would put law in what my book calls the public service cluster, and I'd put writing in a one called the communications and media cluster. But I introduced the concept of clusters for this reason. I want people to think about the occupations that are interested in them, and then all of the occupations that surround that occupation. Because you hit the nail on the head. Sometimes people are going to look at something, and let's say I'm interested in becoming a doctor, and I find out at some point in my life that I don't possess the academic talent to see, succeed in law school. Well, maybe nursing, or maybe something to do in the medical technology laboratory, or maybe to do something to do in hospital administration. Mm-hmm. But if I don't look at the cluster, Rebecca, I don't see the things that are related to some of the occupations that I may have on my list. Well, the other thing I talk about here in this chapter is, and I try to list with every one of my chapter, every one of my clusters, I try to list some of the occupations that didn't exist 5 years ago. They're just kind of jumping on the scene all the time. Career fields are in a constant state of fluidity. Mm-hmm. Some occupations become obsolete and fall by the wayside. Others have to change and keep up with because the knowledge and the skills required to perform them are changing. And some of that change is maybe cosmetic. I found something very interesting when I was writing the book. I was looking for new occupations, and I discovered something that there's a major publisher up in Boston called Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Mm-hmm. They call their receptionist the director of first impressions, not the receptionist.
That's what the person is, yeah.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Subway calls their food preparers sandwich artists. Now, you look back at a 20-year-old occupational outlook handbook and look for sandwich artists, you're not going to find it there.
Right.
Secretaries and stenographers are likely to be administrative assistants in the contemporary workplace. Some things come and stay forever. Some things come and go. Some things come and change. Mm-hmm. More importantly, that someone once said that the student in kindergarten today, that two in five kids in kindergarten today are going to enter occupations that didn't exist the day they started to school. And that makes it a real information challenge. My chapter on clusters is designed to get people thinking about work settings as much as occupations. I want people to think of all the things that go on in communications and media. If I'm interested in radio or television, maybe I want to also be interested in the internet and streaming and all the things that we're now doing in satellite communication. Counselors working with unhappy and disgruntled workers might suggest that people, before they make a major leap, you know, people who don't like their work and find themselves disgruntled or depressed or unhappy, you know, their first reaction is, I got to get out of here. Mm-hmm. I hate this place. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that is not the right kind of adjustment to make. Maybe they need, like your friend, to do something close by to what they're already doing. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is, maybe it's not the job, it's the setting in which the job is performed. If you're an accountant with the Internal Revenue Service at their headquarters in Baltimore, Maryland, you're probably one of 5,000 or 6,000 accountants. If you're an accountant with the Arlington County school system, you're probably one of a dozen or so. Mm-hmm. If you're a CPA in private practice, you're the one and only. Everything falls on your shoulders. Mm-hmm. And there you have the same occupation performed in three different settings, and I contend that those settings make those three occupations or three careers probably pretty different.
Okay, now here's a tough question. The recent recession and any number of other economic and workplace conditions have resulted in significant rises in unemployment. How, as a counselor, can I help someone who has lost their job deal with that situation?
Well, it starts earlier than that. A lot of young people think they're underemployed. You know, the person that goes to college and with great aspirations of coming out 4-5 years later and you know, seeing a bright sunny sky and many opportunities are now finding, you know, you've heard the story about the people in waiting, the people who are waiting tables while they wait for that perfect job to come
yep.
on.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people, and I don't want to discount that that's not a reality. It's also part of the what any kind of an economic downturn and any kind of a recession is going to create. Unemployment can be have a devastating effect on people, mm-hmm. and it can be manifested in multiple ways, and those manifestations are going to find their way to the counselor's office. Mm-hmm. Sometimes clients need dual assistance. The first counseling interface is to get them back to work.
Yeah.
Get them out of the ranks of the unemployed and are out of the ranks of the unemployed, and finding and changing jobs is the, now that's pretty much especially counselors who work for the state employment service are helping people find job or change jobs. Mm-hmm. Counselors who are working in the career services office at a college or university are helping graduates transition from school to college.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are specialty career counselors, people who put out who go into private practice and with the idea that we help people with career transitions only. The other place where a recession or an economic downturn or any variety of other kind of national or political concerns may come to play is that I am convinced that many mental health and private practice counselors are going to find themselves sitting across the counseling office from people who are having difficulty coping with the conditions that brought them to lose their employment. You know, some people get fired for all the right reasons, and mm-hmm. they may not understand why they got fired. Mm-hmm. Some people who didn't get a promotion may not understand why they did not get the promotion. Some of the people who are having family problems and parental problems may not have their priorities straight. Those problems may be tied to career and work issues, mm-hmm. and they're going to find themselves in family counseling or marriage counseling or individual counseling, not because of a career issue, but because of how a career issue ties back to their personal or social or emotional development. This client it's going to present some unique challenges because you're going to have to do a little more sorting and sifting before those kind of things become apparent. But there is clear indication that something like a depression, something like an economic downturn that we've experienced in this country in the last decade is going to find its way and affect a lot of different people in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, you know, one of my early counseling jobs was in a college counseling center, and I was the mental health counselor, and across the street was the career counselor. And we learned to send people back and forth,
yeah.
you know, because sometimes I would be counseling someone, and I'd say, you know, you need to talk to our career counselor across the street. And she told me sometimes she'd be counseling someone, she'd say, this is more of a mental health issue. You need to go see Rebecca across the street. So we were back and forth.
You know, but, let me just comment on your comment.
Yeah.
One of the great things about a college counseling center concept is that I always call it a constellation of services.
Yes.
You know, there's somebody who's working in admissions. There's somebody working in the mental health counseling center. There's somebody working in financial aid. There's somebody working with veterans. There's usually a woman's center. There's usually an intercultural center. All of those people are helping people in different human service ways,
mm-hmm.
but they all work under a roof called college, and mm-hmm. and when they do the things like you said, exchange, send back mm-hmm. and forth, collaborate, then it's truly a constellation of good services to good people.
Absolutely. I was, it was last year, I think, at the ACA conference. I forget which one it was, but I went to a presentation by Mark Savickas, and he said sometimes when you're dealing with somebody who has been unemployed, that sometimes they need to write a new story about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That they, you know, the story they had is I'm going to leave college, I'm going to get a good job, I'm going to stay with that job forever, I'm going to, you know, that was the story. And sometimes, even later in life, people need to write a new story about themselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Rebecca, one thing I just thought of I want to add to the thing about recession and so
mm-hmm.
forth.
Mm-hmm.
There are tens of thousands of people in this country right now who are still working, who thought they would be retired by now.
Mm-hmm.
They thought they'd be playing golf somewhere, or they thought they'd be volunteering somewhere. And this recession that we went through and this economic downturn that we just experienced, it stopped them from achieving that dream that they thought they were going to have.
Yes.
And a dream unfulfilled at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea of this being something that happens at any one point in time, that this recession doesn't cut across people and affect people at every different age, is really a non-entity. People
mm-hmm.
at every age, people at every stage of life are finding that the economic downturn and the recession really had an impact on them.
Yes, yes. And another thing, a counselor called me the other day at ACA and was discussing this with me, is there are certain people who are, there's a certain number of people who are retiring every day. The baby boomers are retiring. And she was saying, you know, why aren't there all of these new college graduates that can move into their places? And I said, because they don't have the experience to move into their places.
Well, and you know, and that's an interesting thing. If we don't look across the lifespan, if American business and American industry doesn't have a respect for all ages and a respect for inclusion of everybody, whether it's men and women, whether it's African Americans and Asian Americans, if we ever revert to the America we once were, that was discriminatory and biased. If we ever do that, we are really, really in danger of stepping backwards instead of stepping forward.
Why is it important for people passing through the stages of career development to utilize the services of professional counselors? And what settings should have counselors in place to address the needs?
Well, I can honestly say without any apology, I'm very biased. I want professional counselors to do the professional counseling that is needed in this country.
Yeah.
And I'm very, very concerned that people who aren't counselors may be attempting to get their hands on some of that, probably for all the wrong reasons. I've often said that part of counselor advocacy is telling people who you are, what you do, where you are, and how they can benefit from utilizing your services. I think the other thing we have to do is we have to pump up our training.
Mm-hmm.
We have to pump up our credentials so that people understand, again, who we are, where we are, what we do. If they know more about us and the interventions that we can help them with, they're going to seek us out when those difficult times arrive in their lives. Now, I also think that counselors have to be both preactive and reactive. Counselors working in settings like schools and colleges have command over a pretty big audience. The counselor who wants to work with adults in private practice doesn't have somebody coming into the classroom every day,
mm-hmm.
doesn't have somebody walking in, getting on a bus and coming to a school every day. So some of our clients are in need of our services but don't know who we are and where we are. Now, I want to make sure that our credentials and our training is known, because there are all sorts of people out there. I'm concerned about the term coaches. Not that there aren't a lot of good coaches out there, but I'm concerned about the fact that the word coach is not regulated.
Mm.
Anybody can call themselves a coach.
Mm-hmm.
I had somebody the other day, I found something on the internet the other day where a man was calling himself the career guru.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I looked on that website for the background of this person who was calling himself the career guru. I could find nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I once remember an advertisement, whether it was on the web or in print, where somebody says, I help people go back to work. And I said, well, that's an interesting thing. This man's only credentials for helping people find jobs was that he said he had been fired 6 times in his life. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sorry that he got fired six times in his life, but that's not a professional credential. Mm-hmm. People who join ACA, people who participate and get a degree in an accredited counselor education program, they're going to have skills, knowledge that eventually will turn itself into competency. Knowledge plus skill plus experience equals competency. I've always gone with that concept. Now, to where should they be? Well, we know that they're in schools and colleges. We know that they're in many government agencies. We know that they're in rehabilitation centers. Mm-hmm. We're seeing more counselors in mental health centers as that counselor has grown over the last 20, 30 years. We see more counselors in community agencies. And clearly, more and more people are branching out and forming those private practice settings. The one area that I think has a whole lot of implications for the things you and I have been discussing is the counselor in an employee assistance program, an EAP. Mm-hmm. Many firms are beginning to recognize more fully that they need to keep their good people happy. They need to, and that happiness is just not only job happiness. I've seen some counseling employee assistance programs that are offering family counseling and are offering substance abuse counseling and all sorts of things because they value and make an investment in their employees. And if their people head off down to their competitor, they've lost that investment. Mm-hmm. Richard Branson, who is the gentleman who founded Virgin Airways and yes. Virgin Atlantic Productions and all those things, once said something, you want to train your people so that they have unlimited opportunity. You want to treat them like they won't use it. and what he was saying was, do all you can for your people. Do all you can to nurture them, but then make sure that you put out a set of employment characteristics where they don't want to leave. Yeah. And now that's not to say that mobility and growth won't cause some people to leave. It will, and that's not going to be a 100% retention kind of a formula for any business or industry. Professional counselors come from good training. They possess good credentials. And I want those to be the people who are providing the primary services in this country as it relates to career development issues.
Absolutely. And, I think of all of the coaches out there, there are some good coaches who actually have a master's degree in counseling, but there are also coaches no real professional counseling experience, and that's who we're concerned about because we know that it's very important that people who are going to be doing this kind of work have professional counseling backgrounds. Now I'm going to go to the last question. This has been very interesting, and this last question is, ACA currently has almost 55,000 members, most of whom are clinicians. Is there anything I have not asked you that you want our members to know?
Well, first of all, I want to commend you on your skills as an interviewer. You and I have talked in advance about some of the things that I might talk about, but you've added so immensely to that I'm very, very happy to have had the opportunity to exchange these views with you.
Thank you.
I want ACA members to understand that life and career are inexorably tied together, and each is likely to impact the other in ways that all counselors must understand. For some, addressing career concerns will be very fundamental. It will be like helping them choose a career or charting an educational path or finding a job or changing a job or winding down when they get ready to retire. Those are all fundamental things. We're all going to do those things. Those are the knowns. But for many others, those concerns will spill over into other aspects of our growth and development. They will have social and cognitive and emotional development connections. This gets a little tougher for the counselor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we need to have counselors concerned about career development and all those other settings I mentioned in a previous question. There's a recent study on job satisfaction, again, by the Society for Human Resource Development. This SHRM study found that 1 in 5 Americans state openly that they don't like what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
1 in 5. Those people are going to find their way to a counseling center or to a counseling mm-hmm. office, and they're going to probably be those people that if they go there long enough and they've had this experience of dissatisfaction long enough, they may be what that interviewer told me recently was chronic career disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Individuals at various stages of a CCD, if that's the new term, are going to find their futures and their satisfaction and their families and their lives are going to be immensely influenced by good counselors. And I want those counselors to be ACA members. I want them to be ethical. I want them to be professional. There isn't any one counseling theory or approach that works better with life and work balance issues than others. There are many. Dealing with them first involves understanding. I think my book, Career Errors, tries to lay a bedrock of what that understanding should be.
Mm-hmm.
And once we have that understanding, we've taken the first step. The last two chapters in my book, Career Errors, I fall under the rubric of a thing called winding down, adjusting, and exiting.
Mm.
And someone once told me recently, the good news is we're living longer. The bad news is we're living longer.
Yeah.
We're not living with the same maintenance of health that we all had. And I don't know whether that's physical health or mental health. We have to deal with so many other life issues. Maybe it's the death of a partner. Maybe it's a financial concern. Maybe we don't have the physical abilities to get around like we did before. Counselors who are working with seniors, counselors who are working in a gerontological context, are just like I want all counselors to understand more about career development. I probably want all counselors working with seniors to know more about senior life, senior living. And because people are doing things longer, but they don't necessarily. Now, on the other side of that is some people need help to adjust to retirement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. if you have been working around people for 40 years and you then isolate yourself, and that isolation is even enhanced by the loss of your partner or your spouse, you know, once the grieving process is over, you're a very lonely person again.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's so much about late life that resembles early life. And there, it doesn't diminish the need for counseling assistance and for good counselors to know a lot about the people they're working with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely wonderful way to end this conversation. I want to thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Frank Burnett, to discuss your book, Career Errors, Straight Talk About the Steps and Missteps of Career Development. To view links to this program, to write to the presenter or the host, go to www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page. This is Dr. Rebecca Daniel-Burke, your host for the ACA 2015 podcast series, signing off.